This is Andy.
And this is Matt.
And you're listening to
The Hop Podcast with No Name.
What a dumb name.
It's so stupid. And we're off. Episode 46. The journey continues. I don't know why I was so excited to say that. I wrote it down like six times in my notes. This is how you're going to start the episode.
No, you didn't.
No, I didn't. It just happened. But we are continuing our conversation with our two fantastic guests.
Yes. So we have Eric and Ron here. If you have not had an opportunity to hear them speak already, we highly suggest you starting with, was it episode 44, Matt? Is that right?
Yep.
Yeah. So episode 44, where we start the beginning of this story, of this transformation, of this thought process change, of this organizational change. So we have Eric. He's the former CEO of Era Energy with us, among other things. And then we also have Ron, who is the former EHS manager for Era Energy while Eric was there. And they are telling us their story, helping us understand. In a previous episode, we had understanding for why there was a desire to make a change in how safety was being managed. And then we moved into what that actual transformation looked like in terms of philosophy, in terms of the beliefs. I think, Eric, is the way that you summarized it. You have to have a beliefs discussion first to understand the philosophy that you're using, the lens that you have, in order to allow us to manage safety in a different way. And now we're moving into what that shift in philosophy starts to look like, moving from an individual level, right? So Eric has the shift in his mind, but then how do you have an entire organization of people start to act in accordance with that philosophy? And then Ron, from your perspective, right, having Eric come into the organization, have a thought process that was fundamentally not aligned with how you nor I were taught originally of what safety looks like within an organization and what that looked like to watch someone with a different philosophy start to change how an organization was functioning in this space. And I am really excited to get to hear these stories because I've gotten a preview of some of it and I just have a huge smile on my face because I'm very excited for other people to get to hear it too.
Same.
So where does it make sense to start? I'll leave that up to Eric and Ron in terms of trying to get this transformation from your mind to a lot of other people. How do you even begin to tackle that strategically?
Well, first let me say, Andy, Matt, great to be back with you all. And I mean, this is a topic I'm very passionate about and super excited to talk about as well. So thanks for the opportunity. You were asking about where do we start? Let me just recount, I guess, where I started. It started from a place of discomfort. I remember coming in to the company, and like a lot of other companies, their definition of safety success is tied to the bonus scorecard, and in our case was TRCF or TRIR, a total recordable case frequency, and that measures, as we all know, the OSHA standard around essentially medical treatment after an incident occurs. And as I talked about in the last episode, I've had experiences through my life where I have really come to grips with how people's lives can change in the field in an instant and really grappled with what can I do as a senior leader to make a difference, to keep people safe, to keep those life-changing, family-changing injuries from occurring. And the discomfort I felt coming in when I started the role at Era was, I remember two exact two stories I'll share with you briefly. One was I was doing a field visit, and it was kind of a quarterly business review, right, where you go and look at the performance of the unit on production, on cost, and safety. And I remember a slide on the screen, and they were touting a set of stairs they had manufactured to go over a ground level pipeline. And these stairs went up and down, had a handrail. I don't know how much it cost for us to bespoke manufacture those stairs, but the team was super excited to show me that as a, as an example of how they are being on the front foot to keep incidents from happening. And as I was looking at this, I was thinking to myself, we are focused on the wrong thing.
That is an amazing visual, Eric. that is an incredible visual.
What keeps me up at night, as much as I don't want somebody to trip on, you know, as they're crossing over a pipeline, is not somebody tripping or maybe getting a cut or a bruise, or worst case, a broken bone. What's the probability of somebody's life changing because they stumbled across that pipeline? There's an edge case where that could happen, but that's not what keeps me up at night. That really concerned me. The other thing was, I remember, and Ron was probably in the room when this happened, but every incident of a certain level gets reviewed by the CEO. So I remember seeing a report out on an incident review session, a learning session, and the remedies that were suggested was essentially more paperwork, more lines in the permit, more shifts to what was written in some document that few people read. And I was thinking to myself, that's not really improving our safety. So the initial steps when I came in were really coming from a place of curiosity about why we're spending efforts doing that, and discomfort that we needed to change it, because if we're focusing on this, we're not focusing on other things that are more important.
So you come in with a lens that's already been adjusted from your previous work, right? Your previous exposure to some of this thought process. And now you're coming in and seeing artifacts of the thought process you used to have, right? The thought process of, because if we go back to the last episode of the idea of trying to reduce, you know, slips, trips, and falls, right? That's a set of stairs is an amazing solution set, right? To try to reduce that. So you're seeing now the artifacts of the thought process that you historically also held on to. It now makes you uncomfortable in seeing it in a way that maybe historically it hadn't. And then Ron, you have this new CEO come in. Do you remember your first encounter with Eric and this philosophy? And can you help us picture it from your perspective?
Thank you, Andy. Only if Eric will put his earplugs in will I stand at this point. The truth is literally within, and I'm exaggerating here, but within Eric's first hour, and it wasn't his first hour, but very early after he arrived, I had an opportunity to meet with Eric over a Teams call. And, you know, the objective was that I would, you know, help educate Eric and onboard him into what our health and safety focus areas were, and what our plans for the coming year would be, and maybe historically where we've been and why we are where we were at the time. And we had been working in the space of SI prevention for over a decade. So it wasn't like we were starting from scratch, and we felt like we were pretty good. And within that first hour, Eric quite appropriately identified that we were really strong in the area of prevention. But in the area of SIF prevention, most of the barriers that we had in place were very dependent upon people being perfect. And they were administrative in nature. And the concept of, you know, accepting or embracing that people make mistakes was really not embedded into those systems and those programs. And not many of our barriers were fail safe. You know, they weren't focused on the right side of the bow tie. They were very much focused on the left side in the prevention space. And he also quickly recognized that what was driving most of leadership was our key performance indicator that was very much focused on total recordable injury frequency. So on one side of the fence, we were talking about SIF prevention, but on the other side, what was really driving the organization was this focus on preventing everything and total recordable injury frequency. And so I think that was where our first interaction occurred, and we began a process of trying to reset our effort and focus around making sure that no one suffers a life-changing injury. And I remember it being not comfortable. I remember it being, you know, oh, great, you know, we got a new CEO. So, you know, these all these plans that we had that we're really excited about, you know, we need to take a left-hand turn. And it's been the best left-hand turn that I've ever taken by far and away. So, that's how, for me, how I got started in this pop space.
Nice. I'm picturing how I think I would feel, Ron, if I was sitting down with a new CEO and talking to kind of our entire safety strategy and then hearing really quickly that perhaps it wasn't aligned with their strategy. Yeah, I can only imagine that for a bit that maybe uncomfortable is not even a deep enough or strong enough word for probably how that felt in the moment of
I think you understand.
I'm just imagining Ron after the first meeting going back to his office and taking a big like clipboard off the wall and walking out to the dumpster and just throwing the clipboard out and be like, I'll start over.
Okay, you know. They wouldn't have a lighter because I need to burn this plan that I have that I'm ready to launch. Yeah. It was something like that. Yeah. Needed a bonfire. That's what I
needed. Needed a bonfire. All right. So Eric's got a philosophy that he's now imparted a bit, at least the general direction to you, Ron. Then what was the next part of the plan? Was there, I mean, from either of your perspectives, from Eric or Ron, was there a plan? I remember Eric in, I think it was the last episode, you talked about if you were Eric 1.0 and somebody was going to come and explain this change in philosophy and kind of help push you in the direction of where you now are, would that be possible? And part of your answer was that it felt really important that somebody would have a clear and seemingly attainable plan to start off with. Did you have one?
Well, I had had the benefit of spending some time in the weeds reading from, you know, about HOP from people like you, Andy, and others who are publishing on this. So I did come in with a framework and had wrestled with this a bit in my brain, but I think what it comes down to is that a central question is, you know, is it possible for our people, our systems, our assets to be perfect? And once somebody asked me that simple question and came to the inevitable conclusion that the answer is no, perfection is not possible, then that, you know, married with a real accountability for owning the culture and systems of my company or my business, then comes the angst. Because if you're in that space where incidents are going to happen because we're not perfect, and I feel responsibility, accountability for my business, it becomes really uncomfortable, because then it's like, okay, what do I do with that? And so, you know, to credit the board I was working with, they were aligned with my thinking on this, that we needed to make a shift, that we need to focus more on preventing, eliminating life-changing outcomes in our business as the animating focus of personal safety. Then we went through a series of steps about how do we get there. Mm-hmm. And what gave me some comfort amongst this moment of angst was the reality that I've run transformations in other domains in the business, right? Cost, production, and the ingredients to execute a transformation, thankfully, I think are similar between any business transformation and safety transformation. That is to say that leadership needs to role model the shift, number one. Number two, we need to foster understanding and conviction within the organization about that shift, why it's happening. We need to develop talent and skills where it's needed in order to achieve the shift. And then we need to reinforce it with our rewards and our formal mechanisms we use in the business. So whether it's a cost transformation or a safety transformation, that gave me a framework or a portal through which to operate. So the first step was really about fostering conviction amongst the leadership group and amongst the board. Mm. And so so that's really where we spent the time, a beliefs conversation about, just as I said, you know, is it possible for our people, processes, equipment to be perfect? If not, then what do we do? And ultimately, I came to the conclusion that before we go and talk to the organization about a new way of approaching safety, this belief that incidents will occur, we need to focus on life-changing potential and all the things that come with it, we needed to change the definition of what good looks like at the highest level. And so in our company, like a lot of others, TRCF was the measure that linked to people's bonuses. And I understand why public and private companies everywhere use TRCF and TRIR, because it's consistent across companies. But as we've talked about before, majoring on TRCF and TRIR, I think, leads to behaviors that are essentially counterproductive to focusing on what keeps me up at night, which is life-changing injuries. It's not, let me reinforce this point. It's not that we don't measure TRCF and TRIR. We did. We continued to do that, and we discussed it with the board. But the shift was, we started to measure high potential incidents and a certain type of high potential incidents, which we'll talk about in a moment, as the definition about what good looks like in the company on safety. And we tied that to the internal bonus mechanism. Mm. That was a really important shift that we had to make, because if we're going to tell people that we really want you to focus on life-changing injuries and we want to put our efforts in improving the barriers there first, then we have to follow that up with the reward mechanisms and the incentives that exist in the company. So the first step was to partner with the vice president of safety and myself. We went to the board and talked about making this shift on how we reward safety, how we're going to measure it, and linking it to SIF prevention, that is that's at the core of the first steps we made. And then it was, when we unveil that to the organization, then you start talking about why. Mm. And why we believe that's going to drive us to focusing on the right things to really get at keeping people safe and preventing life-changing injuries.
So let me recap some of this, because Eric, what you're saying strikes me as incredibly important. And there's several things that you said that strike me as important. The first was that once you at least recognize the direction you wanted to go in philosophically, then the next part of what to do fell into a model that you had at least seen and done before in terms of how you transform an organization, whether it be around safety, whether it be around cost, whether it be around any aspect of business. And you listed off four things that I want to make sure that I got correctly. First, as the leader, you're the role model of this. So you actually have to walk the walk in terms of what you, the direction you want to go in. And a lot of that then is tied intimately to these other aspects of the change, which is being able to articulate the why aspect, not only for yourself, but for the entire business and the buy-in for the individuals, which then, in order for that to be real for anyone, has to be tied directly to the incentives, right? The things that affect someone's belief of what good looks like, not just for the organization, but then for their job, right? Because the incentives of their job are the measure of what is good for their job. But then obviously in that you have to give people the skill set to be able to achieve it. So you can't just tell people to go execute it without the skill set to achieve it. Did I get those right? Those four, right?
100%. 100%. Okay. And I found that recipe works very well. If you execute it with discipline. Yeah.
And what's really helpful and important from your perspective is that there's a lot of organizations that the folks that have a desire to make this type of change are not sitting in your seat. So they're not in the C-suite. So they don't have the ability to affect the incentives directly. And so they spend a lot of time and energy on the role modeling, the why, the trying to upskill themselves and upskill the people around them. But directionally, it always feels in conflict with the business, because the measure of what good looks like still isn't aligned with the execution of what people are trying to achieve of their version of good. And so there's always this disconnect that exists until there's enough movement or enough influence that suddenly someone in the C-suite starts to see that there's benefit here. And then there's discussion around changing incentives. But some organizations, that takes many, many years to get there, because they don't have the version of you sitting in a seat that has the ability to go sit with the board and have this discussion of, hey, we really want to do this differently. But what I'm hearing, which is when somebody does have that ability, that there is a fundamental driver in the direction of the behavior of an organization that can be created by what we are measuring, specifically because it's tying to what we believe good is. So the measurement and what we believe good to be have to be aligned in some way. And that helps turn the head of the organization in the same direction, because now we have the same version of what good is. And this then becomes the fundamental question that many, many, many organizations have, Eric, of what is that? Like, what do you measure? What does good look like? How do you know that something is safer than it was before? And how are you so confident in that it's something that a board of directors would be like, yeah, we see it too. We see the same thing you do, and that seems like a good measure.
That is a huge dilemma about how do you measure what good looks like in this space. So if you acknowledge that, let's go back to the first principles. If you acknowledge that we are not perfect and therefore incidents will occur, what good looks like is not allowing those incidents to escalate into life-changing consequence. And therefore, as a result, you may get a cut, you may get a bruise, you may get a broken bone. So how do you measure that? Well, I mean, a lot of companies measure high potential incidents. Some people call it others, potential significant incidents. But that in and of itself, just changing from TRIR to PSIF, potential serious incident frequency, I also found to be unsatisfying.
Mm.
I'll give you an example. So if you have somebody working at height, and if they are working on scaffolding, as we've seen 100 times, right, and they're wearing a harness, and inevitably, as things happen, they slip because they're imperfect, and the harness works perfectly. It's been checked, it's been rated, it does what it was expected to do. And that person does not suffer a life-changing injury, but maybe has a bruise on their leg because they hit the... For me, I don't want that person to ever get hurt, have that bruise. But I am, inside my heart, I'm thinking to myself, thank you. That is success.
Mm.
Something imperfect happened, and our systems were robust enough to accommodate the mistake.
Yeah.
The system was robust enough to accommodate the mistake. So how do you measure that? Again, measuring all PSIFs or hypos aren't good enough, because that incident would be a hypo, would be a PSIF. It had the potential to kill him or her. But in my heart, that actually, I want to reward that. Here's the inevitable happened, and they were, the barriers worked. The system was robust, not brittle. So what we came up with was a measure that says high potential incidents where we fail lucky, where luck was the barrier that worked, that's what we're going to measure as a negative. And that is to say, that incident where the person fell and their harness protected them, we failed safely. That should not be counted against the scorecard, in my view. So we started measuring the high potential incidents and dividing them into fail safely, fail lucky. Fail lucky is bad. Luck should not be our barrier. Right? What we want are incidents where we are, when we fail, we are failing safely 100% of the time. And so Ron can talk a little bit more about what this meant, but as soon as that philosophy was agreed, then came the hard work of creating a baseline and going back into history and essentially going through all the incidents that we had had in the past and making that demarcation. Because we knew that if we were to go to the board and say, here's what we're going to measure what good looks like, we had to have a baseline in the history of the company with which to say, are we improving or not? Right?
Yeah.
And so that was really the essential step to work with the board on this, to work with the safety organization, to create credibility in that measurement. So that if we were going to hang our hat and say that's what good looks like, that people would believe it internally and with the board. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So if I'm picturing this properly, right, we've established that in order for this to be a credible change and signal a change to the organization, that we're going to have to change what good looks like so that everyone's looking in the same direction. And to do that, you pointed out that a lot of organizations have moved to looking at things that have high potential for catastrophic failure and measuring when we have incidences happening that could have had that potential or did have that potential. But the measurement that you all chose to go with is one that takes that thought process into something that you actually do have the ability to differentiate between, was the consequence that we ended up with something that was intentionally controlled, meaning we recognize that we will have the loss of control at some point in time of somebody slipping while on scaffolding, right? We just acknowledge that there's imperfection in so many different things, and at some point in time that will happen. Now, the difference between that person losing their life or just getting banged and bruised up, which could result in recordability, absolutely. But the difference between those two things has to do with the rest of the system design. Were we able to fail safely? And were the elements of being able to fail safely actually usable, have operational fidelity? People were able to execute to it. It didn't feel as though it was so entirely cumbersome to use these barriers that people were not using them. Like, what was the actual health of the barrier itself to allow the person to be able to be working in a position where, when the inevitable bad thing happens, the inevitable imperfection happens, that the result isn't catastrophe. The result is something lesser than that, right? Something more controlled than that. And then measuring the difference, right? Did the person fall, but they weren't wearing fall protection, but they happened to land in a bush and then only, you know, broke their leg? That would obviously be failing lucky, right? Failing that it wasn't worse than that. Or was the person wearing fall protection maybe, you know, dislocated something while doing it, but never hit the ground and actually farly reduced the consequence that you would see if they weren't wearing fall protection? That would be failing safe. Am I getting that differentiation properly?
Yeah, totally. And let me just make this really simple. What I really wanted and what the board wanted was to incentivize the right things, which is to say, I want people 100% focused on those barriers that are going to keep people from a slip or a mistake and a fatality or a life-changing injury. I want people 100% focused on those barriers being healthy and strong. Mm. If I'm going to choose what people I want people working on, I will sleep a lot better if I know that those barriers are strong across the organization. Because when the inevitable happens, when a mistake occurs or an imperfection occurs, that it's not going to escalate into a family member being called with terrible news. Mm. That's what keeps me up at night. And that's what animates this. So getting credibility in that measurement mechanism was going to drive the right behaviors in the field. And so I asked Ron and the safety organization to define that system to help me and the operations leadership go to the board and win their support. And from that, we can then go and put in place systems that are going to help us make the business stronger.
So now I'm trying to picture this from Ron's perspective, right?
Me too.
So let's fast forward just a little bit, if it makes sense for you all. We've gone to the board, Eric. You've been able to articulate well why this measurement makes sense, why it aligns with the philosophy that feels like the right way to be managing in the safety and the environmental space, and then. Now something has to happen to make that metric real to other people. And Ron, can you tell us from your perspective, like the part of the story of that metric then becoming part of your life, or how did it go from the board to then the rest?
So you guys articulated that so well, and so if you can imagine for the decade prior to this moment, working hard on SIF prevention, but the reward mechanism being reduction in TRIR and how those were misaligned, how difficult it was to make inroads in the SIF prevention space. And so when we think about like our belief system, as Eric has mentioned, that if we embrace the fact that, you know, as people, we make mistakes and we need systems that are more fail safe. And if we believe that the new definition of safety is no longer TRIR, so breaking up with divorcing ourselves from TRIR, right, that was like a major cultural moment for us. Yeah. You know, safety is the presence of barriers. Safety is the presence of controls. And then creating a system that measures those things, attempting, and nothing's perfect in this space. It's always difficult. And along the way, I was asked by peers outside of our organization, aren't you afraid your TRIR is going to go up? And you know, within a short period of time, I was able to clearly say, I'm not worried about that at all. Because my leaders are no longer interested in whether or not their worker received prescription medication or not. But they have no interest in that. They have interest in knowing that their worker is getting the care that they need. And culturally, that was a substantial difference. And that they're also interested in, you know, what SIF prevention. They're no longer interested in the recordable record-keeping criteria. They're interested in what are the barriers that we have to have in place to avoid the PSIF that will count on the scorecard. You know, creating metrics that drive interest in SIF prevention and care for people and the presence of barriers, leading indicators around the presence of barriers is what we were after. And that's what we experienced. We experienced such a different level of engagement with leadership, what they were focused on, and the types of engagements they were having with their team just changed almost overnight. It was really incredible. I didn't know what was going to happen when these changes were going to be made or were made, but what we ended up experiencing was everything that we had hoped it would be. We did not see an uptick in TRIR. Some organizations have seen a slight uptick, but when it's not your KPI, it was not your measure of success, does it really matter? I mean, the reality of it is that whether or not that hit your scorecard or not in the past, those events were still happening. That medical treatment was still necessary, whether we accept it or not. And so creating a less tension in the TRIR space and creating more focus on preventing serious injuries and fatalities and ensuring the presence of barriers as our definition of safety, I think that was the key moment for
Ron. One of the things that you mentioned in your explanation hits home to me in a couple different ways, and I'm wondering if we can talk about it a little bit. The first is this shift in how you saw the leadership thinking about giving medical care to people. Meaning that when we walked away from the idea that we can get to zero and recordability is the thing that is the most important metric, and that's the thing that we're going to spend all of our attention on, it shifted the way that people were responding to lower level injuries. And specifically what I mean by that is one of the things that used to make me terribly uncomfortable in my own role in safety was the fact that I went to a class and used to teach a class on managing recordability, meaning that somebody's been injured and then there's an entire art to trying to make sure that that injury doesn't hit a metric. And that art includes being really specific with where it happened, when it happened, how it happened, what the person was doing at the time, whether they were there for business or not business, and being very specific with those, understanding all those details. But the other piece, which is the part that made me uncomfortable, is the fact that we would statistically see a difference in recordability if we had, for example, an on-site doctor that knew how to work in the operational space. Meaning that doctor knew the rules of recordability and would work within the constraints of that while also trying to make sure that he or she was giving the best care to the employee. But because they were aware of, for example, how many milligrams of painkiller or ibuprofen would make something recordable, they would work really hard to give care in a way that would not hit the metric. And that always felt like a competing priority in a very negative way, in a way that made me physically uncomfortable. I mean, I remember examples of people not being given antibiotics proactively, but having a follow-up appointment to make sure that there wasn't an infection because the antibiotics themselves would make it recordable, but maybe they didn't need it. So maybe they could come back and then we would double check to make sure they didn't need it. And it just felt like a competing priorities that I don't think anyone really liked. It sounds as though some of that was relieved through making this change. Am I picturing that right, Ron, in terms of how people started to respond to just care? Just
completely. Like what you just described as, you know, in terms of our profession, not our proudest moment, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes we might describe what you were laying out as conservative care.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the word for it, conservative care. And, yeah. You know, so what we saw was a shift in interest that our leadership displayed. No longer did they have interest in whether we conservatively provided medical treatment or not, to a place where they wanted to make sure that they got everything that they needed or potentially could have needed.
Mm.
And that was a much, as someone who's concerned about people and providing exceptional care for people, that feels way better and right compared to what we were focused on in the past. So shifting away from TRIR completely changed what we were focused on. And so some folks talk about KPIs being, you know, the things that you want to keep people interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we want to be interested in SIF prevention and the presence of barriers, shifting away from that was important. But if we're talking about the laying out the moose in the room,
mm-hmm.
you know, to say that there's not pressure, you know, to manage, you know, that part of the business and how much SIF potential might exist, you know, that would probably not be very, I wouldn't be very honest about it. But minimally, our leadership was now not interested in medical treatment. They're interested in whether or not we had intended barriers. So minimally, we've already made progress. We've already made progress by eliminating, divorcing ourselves from TRIR, because the things that our leaders now are interested in is the presence, whether we failed lucky or
failed safe. Yeah.
Failed safe. And so that's a much better conversation for us to be having. And I would go on to say, fortunately, we had an organization that gave us, you know, the psychological safety that we needed to make sure that we were able to maintain integrity in the process, created a system where we felt like our evaluations were repeatable over time. And certainly they evolved as we, you know, kind of learned more and perfected our evaluation techniques. Eric, it sounded like you wanted to build
just
on something.
Just listening to you talk, Ron, and I wanted to just come in on this one. I do care what the TRIR is. But what's animating all of this is incentives matter. And it's about where do we put our emphasis. So, for example, let me just say this. Every business has more good ideas than time and resources to implement them. And one way that we signal what the priority should be is what do we measure success on? So, and at the board level, we still reviewed the TRIR. It was a bullet point on the slide, but we spent the time on how are we doing on preventing PSIFs where we failed lucky. That drives the behavior in the organization where people have a choice to make between, do I spend my time in the day on case managing a recordable, or do I spend my time in the day looking at the barrier health for you know, some job that's coming up that could change a life, I can tell you what I want them focused on every day. I want them focused on what's going to keep us from having an incident escalate into a life-changing injury. That is the magic. That is what is important about shifting the focus and shifting what's driving the incentives, is to create the shift in behavior where we have limited resources, limited time in the day to focus on barrier health. Mm. That's the essence. That's the shift.
And what I'd love, oh, sorry, Eric, keep going. What were you saying?
I was just going to say the incentive change was instrumental and I would say foundational. And I would say impossible to make real progress on HOP without it.
Mm.
That may be a controversial thing to say, but I believe it.
Yeah. And I believe you. Right? So this is actually one of the things that I'm hoping next episode we can start up with, because for those who are in this HOP space, you know that there's a lot of sentiment around measurements, meaning I think because of the history that many of us have with seeing what it looks like from the front line of a directive coming down, measurements of some sort of metric being rolled up, what happens to make a number look good, right? So when you're in the trenches and you can see the nitty gritty, ugly details of what happens to make that number appear good enough, that we've had a lot of discussion. I think we've said many, many times, you know, metrics without context can be dangerous. We don't know what they mean unless there's contextual information. And what I love so much about this conversation is that we have the opportunity to hear it from both positions, meaning Eric, you're the one that's in a seat where you can see the scorecard, right? The scorecard's in front of you and it's giving you some indication of the health of what's going on around you, which is an essential tool that you need in order to know what's happening. And then we've got Ron, who is closer to understanding the nitty gritty details of what went into those numbers to get it to you. And that's what I'm very interested in understanding, sort of the details of what it looked like. Meaning, Eric, when you say this is the direction we're going in, what happened? Meaning, who was trying to do what? What behaviors did that drive? Were the behaviors all aligned with it? Were they not all aligned with it? What does it look like when you say, hey, we're going this direction, this metric is now what we're measuring, now what? And then Ron, you have this unique seat of being able to be in the middle of the now what? Because Eric, I think in general, in this HOP space, that we have undersold the importance of shifting a metric. Many times because the person who has the ability to change that isn't usually the person that's primarily trying to drive the change at the beginning, right? It almost takes years for somebody in the C-suite team to be able to hear this and shift their thought process. There's usually a lot of other people trying to make this change before it gets to that place. And so at the beginning, there's oftentimes de-emphasis on, yeah, I know that we're measured on this, and I know that the measurement's in conflict with what we're trying to do. And I think that ultimately that messaging can be harmful in some circumstances, because it does de-emphasize what you're saying very clearly right now of that change in metric is a key foundational aspect of what changed the behavior in the organization. And if we don't help people see that that's true, I think we will have failed people, right? So I just want to make sure that we talk to that when we come back in our next episode.
And that's what we'll do.
Perfect.
Perfect. So we'll see you next episode.
Well, that's it.
Yep. Another one in the books. We did it.
If you want to send us any of your thoughts, actually fling us any of your thoughts, you can do so at the website www.hoppodcast.com.
That's hoppodcast.com.
Still such a stupid name.
We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening.